This is Audible.
The Long War by Terry Pratchett and Stephen Baxter. Chapter 35. Jansen was escorted over to the big admin block where Sally waited for her, and, Jansen couldn't quite figure out how she did it, within 30 seconds Sally had given Bart Simpson the slip. They hurried through cramped, badly lit, roughly walled corridors. "Come on," Sally said. "There's things you need to see in this dump." They passed what looked like offices, study rooms, labs, even a kind of computer center. A few people glanced at them, curiously or not, but nobody stopped them or questioned them. They must be used to strangers here. Jansen was getting the impression that this was indeed a loose organization, a bunch of fan types getting together, and no doubt with people coming and going as enthusiasm or other commitments allowed. No security at all. They came to a staircase that led them down into an underground complex, a warren of roughly walled corridors and rooms. Jansen remembered what Frank had said about safety bunkers, and she remembered too the speculation about why Mary the Troll hadn't just stepped away from her tormentors. Keeping her underground would be the simplest way, so she couldn't step at all. And now, as they hurried along, Jansen started to hear music, of a jagged, discordant kind.
"So," Jansen said, "the trolls are gone. What does that mean?"
"Just that," said Sally grimly. "Not from here, particularly, not yet. But I bet the drift away has started. Here, like everywhere else, they're abandoning the Long Earth in general. Look, you know about the Long Call? All the trolls, everywhere, sharing information. Well, it seems they've reached some kind of tipping point."
"Tipping point? About what?"
"About us. About humans. Our relationship with them. All over the Long Earth, they're leaving. Leaving the human colonies, anyhow, it seems. Any world where there's a significant human presence. They're not dumb animals, you see. They learn. And they modify their behavior. And now they've learned all they need to know about us."
Jansen barely understood this, couldn't comprehend an event of such strangeness, of such magnitude.
"Where are they going?"
"Nobody knows."
Jansen didn't bother asking how Sally knew about any of this. She'd seen herself how Sally could move around the Long Earth, and she was somehow tuned into the trolls too, and their long call. To Jansen, Sally was like a homespun embodiment of some all-pervasive intelligence agency, or a ubiquitous corporate presence, like the Black Corporation, maybe. Naturally, Sally Lindsay knew what was going on across all the worlds. And Jansen knew Sally held the cause of the trolls close to her heart. Well, they wouldn't be here otherwise. So she was cautious when she asked,
"Does it really matter?"
Sally winced, but stayed civil.
"Yes, it matters. The trolls are the Long Earth, as far as I'm concerned. Its soul. They're also integral to the ecology. Not to mention, damn useful. This fall, on 1,000 farming worlds without troll labor, they'll be struggling to bring in the harvest."
"So," Jansen said, "of course we're going to do something about it."
"Of course we are," said Sally, grinning fiercely.
"Starting with what?"
"Starting with right here. This is the place."
They had come to a door with a jokey hand-painted sign, "Space Jail." The discordant music, if you could call it that, leaked out of the room, sharp, unpleasant, and Jansen resisted the temptation to cover her ears. And when Jansen looked through a spy hole in the door, she saw, cowering in the corner, a troll, a bulky female. She sat slumped, immobile, yet somehow the misery seeped out of her. She had nothing in there save a bowl of water.
"Mary," Jansen breathed.
"Our heroine. I will not."
Sally made the signs as she spoke.
"Well, we're underground."
She thought about what Frank had told her.
"But we are at the gap. Solid rock in one stepwise direction, but not the other. She could step out into vacuum, I guess. Try to reach the cub. She isn't stapled, is she?"
"I don't think so. but she must recoil from the vacuum instinctively. Also, they're using that noise to keep her confused and unhappy. You should meet Kara Themes, the supervisor here, a Brit. What a slimeball. For some reason, he hates the trolls with a passion. He has a background in acoustics, and he said he started his own interaction with them when he found out how to drive them away with discords. Now he's developed that into a weapon, a trap, a cage. But the other thing that's holding her here... Come see. A little further along the corridor was another locked door, this one with a small window. When she looked through this time, Jansen saw something like a crude nursery, or maybe a chimp enclosure at a zoo, with climbing bars, ropes, big chunky toys. There was a solitary troll in there, a cub, playing in a desultory fashion with a big plastic truck. He wore an odd silvery suit, with his head, hands and feet bare.
Mary's infant?
Yes, said Sally.
The handlers call him Ham.
You can see what they're doing.
That's some kind of experimental pressure suit he's wearing. You saw the images. They wanted to use him as a test subject.
They didn't mean to harm him.
No,
but Mary must have had some sense of the danger they were taking him into. The gap is surely a place a troll would avoid. Which is why she protested.
Jansen knew Sally well enough by now.
You have a plan, don't you?
We're only going to get one chance.
Expecting the answer, dreading it, Jansen asked,
To do what?
To bust them out of here.
We take this kid to his mother. We all step away.
And then what?
We go on the run, hide out somewhere, until we can find a proper sanctuary. Maybe wherever the rest of the trolls are going.
I knew you were going to say something like that.
Sally grinned.
And I know you're going to help me. All cops want to cross over to the dark side once in their lives, don't they?
No.
Anyhow, I need you, Jansen.
To do what?
To begin with, to get these doors open. You were a cop. You can do that.
Look, I don't know how much time we have. Can you open this door or not?
Jansen could, and she did. And she was committed. Chapter 36 3 weeks after Sally's stunt, when the news of it percolated back through the outernet to Datum Earth, Lobsang summoned Joshua for a face-to-face meeting, their first for years, the first since Agnes's funeral, in fact. Lobsang. As was his way, Joshua spent 24 hours thinking about it, then, reluctantly, he went along. The Transearth Institute facility to which Joshua was directed, a couple of miles from the footprint of Madison on Earth West 10, turned out to be a low, blocky, sprawling structure of the ubiquitous low-earth architecture, stone and timber, standing alone on a deserted stretch of road that cut through banks of prairie flowers. Of course, Lobsang would have set up this office of his own part-owned subsidiary of the Black Corporation at a stepwise Madison, to be close to Agnes and the home. A low-earth it might be, but this was still a different world, with a subtly different late-afternoon sky. Back on the datum, on a June day like this, the horizon would have been tinted orange-grey, the beautiful and deadly colours of combustion. Not here. This sky was a deep, flawless blue. In a way, such comparative emptiness, such cleanliness, even so close to the datum, gave Joshua a renewed sense of the sheer immensity of the corridor of worlds that was the Long Earth. Inside the facility, Joshua encountered the usual office clutter. Deceptively uncomfortable chairs, stricken rubber plants, and a determinedly pleasant young lady who did everything but check his chest x-rays before allowing him to pass on. There seemed to be a camera in every angle of the walls, each watching him steadily. At last he was directed through a self-opening door into a white-walled corridor. As Joshua followed the corridor, another camera swiveled, following him, its lens glittering with paranoia. The door at the far end of the corridor opened,
and a woman stepped out.
Mr. Valiente? So glad you could make it.
She was small and dark, Asiatic, and wore the largest spectacles Joshua had ever seen. She held out her hand.
My name is Hiro. Welcome to Transearth. You need to wear this badge.
She handed him a badge on a lanyard, with the Transearth name and chessboard knight logo, and his name, mugshot, and a scrambled code that could represent anything from his shoe size to his DNA sequence.
Wear that at all times, or our security killer robots will zap you with their laser beam eyes. Just kidding.
Really?
Oh, sure. You may be interested to know that you've already cost Selena Jones a dollar. You remember Selena?
I remember Selena. Is she still Lobsang's legal guardian?
Under some jurisdictions, yes. She wagered me you wouldn't come, that you wouldn't respond to Lobsang's call for help.
Did she now?
But curiosity is a wonderful thing, is it not?
That and a fool's residual loyalty, he thought.
This way, please.
Hiro led Joshua now into a big, low-ceilinged room with picture windows looking out over a stretch of prairie. There were monitor screens all around the place and a worn keypad on the desk, which was a slab of oak 6 inches thick. It was the kind of office that might belong to someone who enjoyed their work and didn't do much else but work. More interesting was the stone trough in front of one window. The plants in it were trumpets, fully 5 feet high, a pale green with red and white ribbing. They clustered together as though they shared a secret, and gave Joshua an uneasy feeling that it wasn't just the air currents that were making them move.
Sarracenia gigantica, said Hiro. They're carnivorous, you know.
They look it. When's feeding time?
She laughed prettily.
They're only interested in insects. They secrete a nectar, a drugged bait, that's got interesting commercial possibilities. We got the original seeds from one of the stepwise alternates, of course.
Which one?
You couldn't even begin to afford to buy the answer to that question, she said pleasantly, motioning him to a chair. Just a moment, please, while I process you through the final stages of security.
She tapped at the keypad.
That's our trade, you know, here at Transearth. We buy and sell commercially useful information.
So this wasn't just a black-funded playpen for Lobsang, then, Joshua thought cynically. He supposed it would be characteristic of Douglas Black to demand a profit.
There, you're in the system. Please do wear your badge at all times. So, are you ready to meet Lobsang?
Hiro took him out of the building, and they walked in the grounds. The evening was gathering now on this world, as on all the others. A few streetlights sparked on the local horizon, and the sun hung low in the sky. But there was a faintly sulphurous smell in the air. The news today was that this world's copy of Yellowstone was a little more restless than most of its brothers. Reports of trees being poisoned by acid seeps, for instance. Evidently there was ongoing geological unrest at the Yellowstone footprint across most of the low earths. On the datum itself, there had been an explosion that had killed a hapless young park ranger called Herb Lewis. Not a volcanic eruption, the scientists emphasized, a hydrothermal event, an explosion of trapped, superheated water, all minor events. Minor. Even from here, 1,000 miles away from Yellowstone, Joshua thought he could smell this particular world's minor event, and, remembering the apocalyptic nutjob who had accosted them at the Datum Twain station about fire and brimstone at Yellowstone, he felt a prickle of unease. Hiro sat down on a slab bench carved out of one great balk of timber.
Please, we will wait here for Lobsang.
Joshua sat stiffly.
You are nervous about meeting him again, aren't you?
Not nervous, exactly. How can you tell?
Oh, the little things. The gritted teeth, the white knuckles. Subtleties like that.
Joshua laughed, but he glanced around before replying.
Can he hear us out here?
She shook her head. Actually, no.
In this place he has limits on his capabilities. Sister Agnes says that's good for him, not to be omnipotent in at least one place in the world. Or the worlds. Why do you think I brought you out here before speaking this way? I didn't want to hurt his feelings.
You're more than an employee, right?
I do think of myself as a friend. He is everywhere, and yet he is very alone, Mr. Valiente. He does need friends. Especially you, sir.
An old man approached through the afternoon light. That was Joshua's first impression. He was slender, tall, with a shaven head, and he wore a loose orange robe. His sandaled feet were dirty, and he carried a kind of rake. Joshua stood up. "Hello," Laub sang. Hero smiled, bowed, and gracefully slipped away.
"First things first," Lobsang said. "Thank you for coming."
The features of this particular ambulant unit reminded Joshua of some of the guises, the bodies Lobsang had donned before. But he had allowed himself to age, or at least, Joshua thought, he had programmed some suite of nanofabricators to carve wrinkles and inflate jowls and make him look somewhere over 60. His posture was bent, his movements slow, and the hands that clasped the rake had slightly swollen joints and skin pocked with liver spots. Of course, it was all artifice. Everything about Lobsang was artifice, and you had to keep reminding yourself of that. But it was impressive artifice, even so. If Lobsang was going to do elderly monk, he was going to get every detail right, down to the frayed hem of his grubby orange robe. Joshua, resolutely unimpressed, didn't feel much like small talk.
"Why did you want to see me? Because of that stunt Sally pulled?"
Lobsang smiled. "In cahoots with your old friend, MPD Lieutenant Jansen, I'll remind you." "Cahoots."
He repeated the word, forming the syllables with exaggerated motions of his lips.
"Lovely word, that. The kind of word that's necessary to use, purely for the pleasure of saying it. One of the many unexpected joys of incarnation. What were we saying? Oh, yes, Sally Lindsay. Well, her tunneling out with the troll Mary and her cub has made the news across the worlds."
"Tell me about it," Joshua said ruefully. Thanks to the old footage of the return of the Mark Twain and the liberal use of face recognition software, Joshua was now famously known as an associate of Sally. He had been badgered by the media and by groups adopting various positions on the trolls and the issues surrounding them. Lobsang said,
"Sally's stunt has brought the issue of the trolls and their relationship with humanity to the top of the news agenda, yes. But the whole business has been bubbling up into a crisis for some time. I'm sure you're aware of that. And now the trolls have started to take action of their own, action with direct consequences for us all."
"I heard. Trolls just clearing off all over, right?"
Lobsang smiled.
"Let me show you. Or rather, let my trolls show you."
"Your trolls?"
"There's a pack of them, a dozen or so steps away. My holding here extends stepwise across several worlds."
He held out his hand, as if in invitation.
"Shall we go see?"
There were perhaps 20 trolls in the group. Females sat lazily grooming in the shade of a sprawling tree. The early evening was warm in this particular world. While cubs played, a few young males wrestled in a desultory way, and at the fringe of the pack, adults flickered in and out of existence. And as they worked or played or dozed, they sang, a lively sing-along overlaid with complex hooting harmonies, the melody line repeated in canon to form an unending round. Lobsang led Joshua to a small fenced-off garden area. There were a couple of benches, a water fountain, and, under the broken canopy of a scattering of trees, the ground here was covered in moss, not grass, moss that glowed bright green in the low sunlight.
"Take a seat if you like," Lobsang said. "Help yourself to water. It's clean, from a freshwater spring. I should know. I have to clean the pipes."
He got down stiffly onto his hands and knees and began to work his way across the moss lawn, plucking out stray blades of grass, like removing weeds.
The rare old mountain dew, he said.
What's that?
The song the trolls are singing. An old Irish folk song. You know, it's possible to date the first contact with humans of any given troll pack by the songs they sing. In this case, to the late 19th century. Do you remember Private Percy? I have carried out such an exercise tentatively. The result is a kind of map of natural steppers in the pre-Willis Lindsay era. Though, of course, it's not always possible to track back the trolls' own wanderings.
What did you mean by your trolls, Love Sang?
He shuffled forward, working at the lawn patiently. A figure of speech. I found this pack in a cornbelt world. I invited them to follow me here as best I could. There are other groups here. Of course, they are no more my trolls than Shimi was my cat on the Mark Twain. But I have created a reserve here, and on the neighbouring worlds, many square miles in extent, and many worlds deep. I have kept out humanity, and done my best to make the trolls, this pack and others, feel welcome. I have been striving to study them, Joshua. Well, you know that I have been pursuing that project for 10 years, since our journey on the Twain and our visit to Happy Landings. Here I can watch them in conditions approaching their wild state.
And is that the reason for the humble pose, Lobsang? You, a superhuman entity that spans 2 million worlds, reduced to this?
He smiled, not interrupting the rhythm of his work. Actually, yes, it does help with the trolls. I am a constant presence, but not an alarming one. But I would not use words like reduced. Not around Sister Agnes, anyhow. In her eyes, I am expanding my personality.
Ah, this was her idea, was it?
I'd got too big for my boots, she says.
That sounds like Agnes.
If I wanted to be part of humanity, I had to become embedded in humanity, down in the dirt, at the bottom of the food chain, so to speak.
And you went along with it?
Well, there wasn't much point going to all the trouble of reincarnating the woman if I'm not going to listen to her advice, was there? This is why I felt I needed her, Joshua, or someone like her, someone with the sense and moral authority to whisper doubts in my ear.
Is it working?
I've certainly learned a lot, such as how much less ornamental an ornamental garden seems if you're the one who has to sweep up the leaves, how to handle a broom, which requires a certain two-handed dexterity and a kind of rolling energy conservation strategy. And it's remarkable how many corners you discover there are in the world. Some pan-dimensional paradox, perhaps. But there are chores I particularly enjoy. Feeding the carp, pruning the cherry trees.
Joshua imagined Agnes laughing her reincarnated head off, but he didn't feel particularly amused.
Lobsang was aware of his stillness. Ah, the old anger still burns, I see.
What do you expect? It had been 10 years ago, after he had returned from his journey with a lost avatar of Lobsang to the reaches of the Long Earth to find Madison a blistered ruin, destroyed by a fanatic's backpack nuke. He had barely been able to bring himself to speak to Lobsang since.
You still believe I could have stopped it? Lobsang said gently. But I was not even there. I was with you.
Not all of you.
Lobsang, by nature a distributed personality, had always claimed that the essence of himself had travelled with Joshua into the far stepwise worlds, and that essential core of him had not returned. Whatever Joshua spoke to now was another Lobsang, another personality locus, partially synced with the residual Mark Twain copy, thanks to memory stores Joshua had brought back. Another Lobsang, not the same. And not the Lobsang Joshua had known, who presumably still existed far away. But this was the Lobsang who had witnessed the destruction of Madison, and had stood by.
Even then, when the Twain returned, 10 years ago, you were... Joshua groped for the old religious word. Imminent. You suffused the world, or so you claimed. Yet you let those nutjobs walk into the city with a nuke. You let Jansen and the other cops run around trying to find them, while all the time... Lobsang nodded.
All the time I could have snapped my metaphorical fingers and put an end to it. Is that what you would have wanted?
Well, if you could have, why didn't you?
You know, throughout the ages, people have asked the same question of the Christian God. If he is omniscient and omnipotent, why would he allow the suffering of a single child? I am not God, Joshua.
Joshua snorted. You like to act that way. Broom and sandals are not.
I cannot see into the souls of men and women. I only see the surface. Sometimes I find I have not even imagined what was lying within, when it is eventually revealed through word or action. And even if I could have stopped those bombers, should I have? At what cost? How many would you have had me kill in order to avert an action that would have remained entirely hypothetical? What would you have thought of me then? Humans have free will, Joshua. God will not, and I cannot, stop them harming each other. I think you should talk to Agnes about this.
Why?
She might help you find it in yourself to forgive me.
Joshua thought he could never do that. But he had to put it aside, he knew. With an effort, he focused on his surroundings. So, the trolls. What have you learned about them?
Oh, a great deal. Such as about their true language, which has nothing to do with the crude signing and point-at-the-picture pigeon humans have imposed on them when they want to give them orders.
But even that's pretty powerful, love saying. You see clips of Mary saying, I will not, everywhere. On posters, in graffiti, online, even on animated T-shirts.
That's true. But it's irresponsible for the tax rebels of Valhalla to mix up their symbols with those of the troll issue, conflating two separate conflicts, each of which spans the whole of the Long Earth. Lobsang sat back on his heels, convincingly sweating. You know that their music is the heart of the trolls' true language, Joshua. Surely that's no surprise. After contact with humans, they pick up our songs, but they make them their own, spinning endless variations. Music is a way for them to express the natural rhythms of their bodies, from their heartbeats, their breaths, the periodicity of their strides when they walk, even the sparking of the neurons in their heads, perhaps. And they use the rhythm of the song as a timing device, when they want to step together or hunt. Galileo did that, you know.
Galileo?
He used music as a kind of clock to time his early experiments in mechanics, pendulum swings and so on. And of course the trolls' songs carry information. Even a simple disharmony can carry a warning. But there's much more to it than that. Watch them now. I think they're planning a hunt. The flickering of the stepping trolls around the core group was becoming more intense. The returning trolls would add a new line to the ongoing harmonies, loudly or softly, boldly or subtly. The song as a whole was evolving, adapting, and the other steppers seemed to react. I plant food sources around the reservation, Lobsang said. Across the stepwise worlds, I mean. Honeycombs, for instance, and animals for them to hunt, deer, rabbits. The pack works as a kind of single organism in seeking out such resources. Stepper scouts spread out across the worlds, and if one finds a promising resource, a deer herd, say, he or she will return and, well, sing about it.
They're still singing about getting drunk on Irish moonshine, as far as I can tell.
The core song is only the carrier wave, Joshua. I've done some acoustic analysis. There are variations in pitch, rhythm, even the phasing of the song's scraps, that carry information about how far away the find is, how high a quality the food is. Other scouts will pick up on that, go and check it out, and come back with a confirming report, or maybe a contradiction. It's an efficient way for the pack to explore all the local possibilities, and soon they'll settle on a selection. Often they'll switch to another key, or another song altogether, to signal unanimity, and then they step away. Honeybees work this way. When they need to find a new location for the hive, they send out scouts, who come back and dance out the data. Trolls individually are not much smarter than chimps, but collectively, they have evolved a way for the group to make intelligent, robust decisions. But it isn't like human decision-making or democracy, even the kind of democracy you practice out in the boondocks. He smiled at Joshua. I heard they made you a mayor.
Sort of.
Tightly contested election, was it?
Oh, shut up. My main job is to moderate the town meeting. Hell knows where is still small enough for all the capable adults to gather on the common land and debate the issues. We use Robert's Rules of Order.
Very American. But maybe there's something of the troll's collective wisdom in what you're practicing. Sooner that than suffer the errors of a single wrong-headed leader. The trolls almost always get it right, Joshua, even when I set them some pretty intricate puzzles to solve.
Nobody's observed this before, have they?
Nobody's had the patience. People always focus on what the trolls can do for them, not on what the trolls want, not on what they can do.
How come our chimps don't work that way? I mean the ones on the datum.
I suspect it's an evolutionary adaptation to stepping. Out in the long earth, where your food source may be nearby geographically, but a few worlds away stepwise, you need different search and cooperation strategies. The scouts have to spot the food and return quickly with the news. The group must decide to move in on it rapidly or not. It's an environment which encourages efficient scouting, precise detailed communication, and quick, robust decision-making, just as we see here. But again, there's still more to the music of the trolls than the needs of the moment. The long call, the essence of which is spread across the worlds, is a kind of encoded shared wisdom. The call can last a month before it repeats, and is laden with ultrasonics beyond human hearing altogether. But even more than that, it's like a smearing out of consciousness, like nothing humans experience. I've been making efforts to decode it. You can imagine the challenge. I'm making some progress. I have a kind of translation suite in various prototypes.
If anybody can achieve that, you can, Lobsang.
That's true, Lobsang said complacently. But right now, Joshua, the long call is vibrating with bad news for the trolls. Bad news because of us. Watch this. He stood stiffly and held up his hands. I am trying to study the trolls in their natural state. I made of this group one basic request, though, that in return for the sanctuary I offer them, protection from humans, they stay here until I release them. Verbally, I mean. They aren't physically restrained in any way. Simple as that. And now, Joshua, I will release them. He clapped his hands once, twice, sharply.
The trolls stopped singing. They stopped stepping once the scouts had returned, and every head, save for the smallest infants, turned to Lobsang. After a few heartbeats of silence, they broke into a new song, a lilting ballad.
Galway Bay, Lobsang murmured to Joshua. And then they began to step away, mothers with cubs first, males last for protection from predatory elves. In less than a minute, they were gone, leaving only a scuffed patch of ground.
Joshua understood. Gone with the rest, just as the reports say. All over the long earth.
It's true, Joshua. And that is what I wanted to speak to you about. Come, let's walk. I'm getting stiff from my weeding. Across the worlds, June skies remained clear. Sun set in unison like synchronized swimmers diving, and dark gathered softly, slowly. On one world an owl hooted, for reasons best known to itself. And Lobsang spoke further of the trolls. They've become vital to the economy of the whole of mankind, including the datum, if only indirectly. So the corporations, including the Black Corporation, are putting on a lot of pressure, wherever they can apply it, to get the trolls back.
And back at work.
Yes. Also, there are security implications. Worse than the trolls disappearing, if they were to be seen to become an active threat to mankind, if a coordinated military response were provoked, we need to avoid that. But there are other, more fundamental issues. The more I study trolls, the more convinced I am that they are central to the ecology of the wider Long Earth itself. Like the elephants of the African savanna, they've been out there for millions of years, and for all that time they've been shaping the landscapes they inhabit, if only by eating so much of them. Sally Lindsay taught me this. She studied them in the wild in her way, far longer than I have. If you remove the big beast from an ecology, you can cause something called a trophic cascade. Knocking out the top of a food chain causes destabilization all the way down, booms and crashes of populations, and that can even cause a rise in greenhouse gases and so on. A tremor of extinctions and eco-collapse all across the Long Earth, or at least as far as the trolls reach, and all because of us.
Joshua grunted. Makes you proud.
The trouble is, Joshua, there's no particular reason for the trolls to return. Before Step Day, they had a long and deep contact with humans, and they were treated decently, and in turn, they treated us decently.
Joshua thought again of the story of Private Percy Blakeney, a veteran of the First World War trenches, lost and bewildered in the stepwise world into which he'd unconsciously tumbled, who had been kept alive by trolls for decades.
But since Step Day, it's been a different story. The exploitation of that cub for experiments at the Gap was only the tip of the iceberg.
Joshua said, Seems to me we'll only get the trolls to come back if we can somehow persuade them that we will respect them, that we will listen when they say, I will not, as Mary did. Not an easy concept to convey to a humanoid.
I know you tried to convince Senator Starling to campaign for them to be protected under U.S. Aegis law. Even that's not an insignificant challenge.
Yeah, animal protection legislation is a mess.
Not just that, Joshua. For one thing, we'd have to decide what the trolls are.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they don't comfortably fit the old categories, do they? Of human versus animal, the distinction through which we believe we have dominion over nature. It's as if, I think, we'd found a band of homo habilis, something between us and the animal. In some ways, the trolls are animal-like. They don't wear clothes, they have no writing, they have no language that's quite analogous to our own. They don't use fire, as even homo habilis probably did. And yet they have some very human traits. They make simple tools out in the wild, poking sticks, stone hand axes. They have strong family bonds, which is why it's so easy to trap a troll mother if you have her cub. They show compassion, even to humans. They do have their own language in their use of music. And they laugh, Joshua. They laugh. The distinction between human and animal is the clincher, you see. You can own an animal. You can kill it with impunity, aside from feeble anti-cruelty legislation. You can't own a human, not in any civilized society, and killing a human is murder. So should we extend human rights to trolls?
We have, kind of, in hell knows where.
Yes, but you're more sane there than most. The basic quandary is, should we embrace them in our own category of being?
Which is a challenge to our pride, right?
And more, Lobsang said. A challenge to our very self-image. Meanwhile, there are others who argue that the trolls can't be human because they have no sense of God.
Well, not as far as we can tell.
What would the Catholics, for instance, do about that? If trolls have souls, then they must be fallen as we are. That is, tainted with original sin. In which case, it is the duty of Catholics to go out and baptize them, to save them from limbo when they die. But you see, if the trolls are actually animals, to baptize them is blasphemous. Apparently the Pope is preparing an encyclical on the subject. But in the short term, the religious debates are just stirring everybody up even more.
What does Agnes say?
Trolls like ice cream and they laugh. Of course they're bloody human, Lobsang. Now go get your broom. You missed a bit.
That's Agnes, all right. Let's get to the point. Sally dragged me out of my home and all the way to the datum because of this. Of course, Sally found us in the first place 10 years ago because of a disturbance of the trolls, when they fled from first person singular. Now you want me to go out again, don't you? Out into the long earth, beyond the high megas. To do what? Find Sally and Jansen with Mary, I guess. Then what? Find where the trolls are hiding? Persuade them to come out? To join the human world again?
That's pretty much it, Lobsang said. Sounds impossible, doesn't it? And it doesn't help that we're already in the middle of so much upheaval from the Valhallan independence demands.
You want to restore the balance?
You and I always did share the same instincts, Joshua. Lobsang bent to remove a single dead leaf from an otherwise immaculate lawn. Will you do it, Joshua? He didn't ask the question, but left it hanging in the air. Joshua thought it over. He was in his late 30s now. He had a young wife, a kid, a role in society at hell knows where. He was no longer a mountain man, if he ever had been. And now, here was Sally, charging off into the long earth through her soft places, as if challenging Joshua to follow. Here was Lobsang, like a ghost from the past, snapping his fingers once more. Was Joshua just going to jump as commanded? Of course he was. Even if he wasn't the man he used to be, but then even Lobsang wasn't who he once was, quite. They walked on, stepping occasionally from world to world, from sunset to sunset. The troll songs hung in the richly scented air of each world, but Joshua wondered if they were diminishing even as he listened. Tentatively, he said,
Having met you now, I can see your instinct was right.
What do you mean?
You did need Sister Agnes.
Lobsang sighed. But I think I need you too, Joshua. I often think back to our days together on the Mark Twain.
Watched any old movies recently?
That's another thing about Agnes. She won't let me show any movies that don't have nuns in.
Wow, that's brutal.
Something else that's good for me, she says. Of course, there aren't that many movies that qualify, and we watch them over and over. He shuddered. Don't talk to me about Two Mules for Sister Sarah. But the musicals are the worst, although Agnes says that the freezer raiding scene in Sister Act is an authentic detail from convent life.
Well, that's a consolation. Musicals with nuns in, huh?
A voice rang out across the park, a voice Joshua remembered only too well from his own past. Lobsang, time to come in now. Your little friend will keep until tomorrow. She has loud hailers everywhere. Lobsang shouldered his rake and sighed as they trudged across the grass. You see what I'm reduced to. To think I hired 4,900 monks to chant for 49 days on 49 mountaintops in stepwise Tibets for this. Joshua clapped him on the shoulder.
It's tough, Lobsang. She's treating you like you're a kid. Like you were 16 going on 17.
Lobsang looked at him sharply. You can pack that in for a start, he snapped.
But I've got confidence you can overcome these difficulties, Lobsang. Just face up to every obstacle. Climb every mountain.
Lobsang stalked off sulkily. Joshua waved cheerfully.
So long. Farewell.
Chapter 37 Joshua made his way out of the Transearth facility through the reception building in Madison West 10. Of course, he could have stepped away anywhere, but it seemed polite to go back out that way. Besides, he had to give Hero his badge back. Bill Chambers was waiting for him in the foyer.
Bill, what are you doing here?
Well, Lobsang sent for me. He figured you would need a companion for the trip.
What trip?
To find Sally and the trolls. What else?
But we only just spoke about it. He sighed. What the hell? That's Lobsang for you. Okay, Bill. Thanks.
Fair play to him. He says he'll give us some kind of translation gadget so we can talk to the trolls.
If we can find them at all. If I'm honest, I've no idea where to start.
I do.
His ruddy face creased in a wide smile. Which is, I guess, why he sent for me. We have to start with Sally, figure out where she might have gone. How do we do that?
Well, Joshua, you're as close to her as any member of the human race, like it or not. There must be something she's done or said, some clue we can follow.
I'll think about it. Okay, what else?
Then we need to track down them troll lads, and I've an idea about that. Look at this.
He dug an item out of his jacket pocket and handed it to Joshua. It was a tape cassette, a bit of technology 50 years obsolete, or more. Its plastic was worn and grubby, and the label unreadable. The cassette smelled strange, Joshua discovered now as he handled it. Half rutting goat, half patchouli, half chemical. It smelled, in fact, of clear nights in the high megas.
Who the hell plays cassette tapes outside of a museum? What is this, Bill?
A lure.
A lure for what, or who?
Somebody is going to help us. You'll see. So, what first?
I'm going to see my family. Try to explain all this to Helen.
Bill looked squarely at him.
Ah, she already knows, man.
And Joshua remembered that fragment of poetry Helen had quoted at the very beginning of all this. A woman with the west in her eyes, and a man with his back to the east.
Yeah, probably.
As for me, I'm off to get bladdered while I've got the chance. See you in the morning.
Chapter 38. The Benjamin Franklin was summoned to the town of New Purity, 100,000 worlds east of Valhalla, where there had been an ambiguous report of yet more trouble with trolls. Joe Mackenzie stood by Maggie on the observation deck, looking down on the community. From the air, it had a look of competence, town hall, neat fields, and of course, what looked like a large church.
New Purity, huh? He said. What's the name of this sect again?
Maggie checked her briefing.
The Uncut Brethren.
Well, you'd expect a church, but there's no stockade.
No. And look over there.
She pointed at what looked like a charnel pit. Even as the twain descended, Maggie's instincts started pressing alarm buttons. The Uncut Brethren. Maggie had been homeschooled by avowed atheists. Actually, not that avowed. They had argued that an outright fundamentalist atheist was just as bad as the worst fire and brimstone spittle-dribbling Bible puncher, and as an adolescent, Maggie had been fascinated by both extremes. So as a connoisseur of believers and unbelievers, she thought she recognized the Uncut Brethren's type on sight as they gathered before the Franklin party. Uniformly dressed, both male and female, in drab woolen smocks, with long queues of hair down their backs. Still, they seemed hospitable enough, right up until Jake the Troll and his family stepped down the ramp from the hovering twain after the human crew. One young man promptly approached Maggie.
"We don't allow these creatures on our premises, our homes, our farms. They are unclean."
Maggie looked into his face, irritated. But she saw tension there, even grief. Something bad had happened here.
Unclean? How? Also, Jake is not a creature.
The man's face worked.
Very well. Let him tell me that.
Maggie sighed.
Actually, that's possible, just. What's your name, sir?
My name is Immaterial. I speak for all. It is our way.
Maggie felt a gentle but persistent pressure on her arm. It was Jake. She beckoned to Nathan Boss, who carried the troll call.
This alive person, close to dead, gone away. Person was and is not. Song of sadness.
Hearing these scratchy words coming out of the instrument, the brethren stared at the troll. Maggie faced the young spokesman.
What happened here? Just show me.
For answer, he led her away from the neat buildings to that pit they'd spotted from the air. It was indeed a hole in the ground, full of corpses. A dozen bodies in total, she guessed, maybe more. There were no human remains here that she could see, but many humanoids, trolls, and another species Maggie recognized from her pre-mission briefings. Elves, one of the more vicious varieties, if she remembered the detail. Maggie turned again to the young man and said, with a note of command,
"I think you need to tell me your name, son."
He blushed and said,
"Brother Jeffrey, auditor of the Uncut Brethren. We are a contemplative order. We believe the prepared soul can overcome all hostile circumstances."
His voice faltered. The story she extracted from Brother Jeffrey, in between his sobs and mea culpas, had been repeated all over the long earth. Every stepwise earth was a new world, a world for free, a blank slate on which you could write a wonderful life, if you dreamed a strong enough dream and watched your back. Here, the Brethren had built a decent, open township, along, according to Jeffrey, Athenian lines. Their philosophy seemed to be a melange of the teachings of figures that Maggie, in her vague theological understanding, generally identified as the good guys, Jesus, the Buddha, and Confucius among them. But they had not listened to basic warnings that must have been given them by more experienced hands, even before they left the datum. And the peril that had befallen them, out of many possible out here, had been elves. Mac approached her.
"We've done a little forensic analysis on that pit. Captain, it was the elves did the attacking. Defensive wounds only on the trolls. The elves evidently stepped in, targeting the humans."
In her briefings, Maggie had seen records of such bewildering attacks, launched out of nowhere by stepping hunter-killers.
A stockade would have been no use against steppers.
"No, but sellers would. And I don't think this lot dug those either. The trolls got caught in the crossfire. Hell, they may have just been passing through. They may even have been trying to help. Damned unlucky for them, since trolls are getting so thin on the ground. And it didn't do the trolls themselves any good. These guys don't know the difference between trolls and elves, I figure."
"So the colonists turned their guns on trolls and elves indiscriminately?"
"That's about the size of it."
"Thanks, Mac." Jeffrey still stood beside her.
"My mother, my own mother has been taken, and..."
"I know.
But it wasn't the trolls. Look."
She pointed at little Carl playing with kids' toys, much to the joy of the few children here in their drab smocks.
"That is what trolls do. You need to understand the reality of the Long Earth if you're to survive here. And in your case, if there are elves in the stepwise vicinity, that means accepting the trolls. They will help you clear your fields, put up barns, dig wells, and best of all, they'll deter the elves."
He seemed to struggle to absorb that, but his next response was positive.
"How do we do that?
Bring the trolls here, I mean." A difficult question, or at least bad timing, since the trolls seemed to be withdrawing from the human worlds all over. She shrugged.
"Be nice to them. To start with, I suggest that with the help of my crew, you bury the corpses of those trolls alongside those of your own people. Pretty soon every troll on this world and all the other worlds will know about that bit of respect. Oh, and we'll help you dig some cellars before we go. Anti-step precautions, right? And a stockade for good measure."
They worked through the rest of the day. That evening, as the sun went down, the community gathered to listen to the song of the Franklin's trolls. Soon the replies started coming, like echoes from beyond the dim horizon, the ones far away eerily mingling with those nearby, the calls flowing and floating over the landscape and melding into one great symphony. Yet there was a certain emptiness to the sound. This world, like all the human-occupied worlds of the Long Earth, was becoming bereft of trolls, and a silence was falling across all the Long Earth, as if there had been an extinction event, some terrible plague. What a strange phenomenon it was, Maggie thought. She could think of no precedent, nothing like this before.
It was as if all the elephants were withdrawing from Africa, maybe. A rejection of mankind by the natural world. Even her own trolls seemed oddly restless, and she was determined to release them if they showed serious signs of wanting away. The next thing, she thought with resignation, would be demands on her from various homesteaders to bring back their troll labourers. How it was about time the government did something. The Benjamin Franklin hovered over New Purity for 2 more days, before riding high into the air and vanishing stepwise. Chapter 39 Sally knew the world they had arrived at. Of course she did. And of course it was new to Jansen. All of this, like the Gap, like every world beyond the Lows, was new to her. It had taken 3 weeks of travelling since the Gap to get here, with regular stepping and falls through the soft places. Sally could have got here quicker, Jansen suspected, but she had worked to keep them hidden, as well as on the move. And you couldn't move trolls on too quickly. Those big frames took a lot of feeding every day. They emerged from the latest soft place into a landscape that was almost but not quite desert. They stood in a broad valley, with cliffs on either side pocked by caves. On the valley floor were a few stunted trees, the remnants of a broken stone bridge, and a building, one vast cubical mass of shaped black stone. The air was so dry it seemed to suck the moisture out of your flesh, and Jansen instinctively searched for shade. Sally remembered this place well, and the radiation threat, she said. They would be safe enough, as long as they stayed well away from that building. This was the world they had informally called Rectangles, when Sally had found it with Joshua and Lobsang 10 years ago. A world of failed intelligence, it had seemed, and death. The world where Joshua had found a single beautiful artifact, a sapphire ring. A world that seemed unchanged a decade on, save for the detritus of more recent visitors, boot prints in the dirt, campfire scars, archaeologists' trench marker flags. Even some trash, plastic cartons, ripped bags. The troll and her cub wandered off, looking for water, food, shade. Sally got Jansen comfortable in the shade of one of the struggling trees, on a rough bed of their piled-up gear, and covered by a single silver emergency blanket. Then she briskly built a fire. They didn't need the heat, but it might keep any critters away. Jansen said,
"So you've been here before? With Joshua, all those years ago. And we're here because the trolls are here? Or nearby? Hiding out? That's your guess, right? Whatever that's based on."
Sally shrugged, non-committal. Jansen thought she understood by now. During the journey, Sally had kept disappearing for a few hours at a time, a day, sometimes for longer periods, plugging herself into whatever network of contacts and information she had built up out here. Jansen suspected Sally herself would find it hard to sum up the various whispers she'd been hearing from various sources. If she came here, she'd find trolls, or trolls would find her. That was the sum of her instincts. Jansen just had to hope Sally's scraps of information and gut sense added up to a good guide. Jansen gave up thinking about it. It would certainly do no good to ask Sally. Taciturn nature or not, a selective silence was one of Sally's most irritating habits. When Jansen had drifted off to sleep, Sally went hunting. The valley bottom itself was suspiciously flat, Sally thought, just as had been her impression the first time she was here. As if it was all one slab, another artifact maybe, like the building itself. There were slopes of scree at the base of the canyon walls, and here and there green extremophile-type plants, lovers of heat and dryness, struggling for life. At first glance, there was no sign of movement, no animals or birds or even insects. That didn't bother Sally. Where there was greenery of any kind, there were going to be herbivores to browse on that greenery, and carnivores to browse on the herbivores. It was a question of patience. All she had to do was wait. She never carried food, not in the endless larder that was the long earth. A lizard or two would do. Something like a naked mole rat, maybe, a deep burrower.
By the steep valley wall, in the shade of a rock face, she settled on her haunches. This was how Sally had lived her life for a quarter of a century now, ever since she'd left Datum Earth for good, not long after Step Day, when her father had made his ambiguous gift of stepper technology to mankind.